This is Lichtenberg, a cross-section, a radio play written by Walter Benjamin.
As the narrator, I find myself in the pleasant situation of taking a position above all the parties. I mean planets. Because the following events take place between Earth and Moon, or rather, sometimes on one, sometimes on the other. I would violate the laws of interplanetary codes of behavior if I, as narrator, represented the position of either the Earth or the Moon. In order to adhere to the proprieties, I will inform you that the Earth seems as mysterious to the Moon, which knows everything about the Earth, as the Moon does to the Earth, which knows nothing about the Moon. You can infer that the Moon knows everything about the Earth, and the Earth knows nothing about the Moon, from the single fact that there is a committee for Earth research on the Moon. You will have no trouble following this committee's negotiations, but in order to enable you to easily gain an overview, please allow me to point out the following. The Lunar Committee's negotiations are very brief. The time allotted for speaking on the Moon is greatly restricted. The Moon dwellers obtain nourishment exclusively from the silence of their fellow citizens, which they therefore only reluctantly interrupt. It is also worth mentioning that one Earth year amounts to only a few Moon minutes. Here we are dealing with a phenomenon of temporal distortion, a phenomenon with which you are doubtlessly familiar. I hardly need to mention that photographs have always been taken on the Moon. The Society for Earth Research's machinery is limited to three apparatuses that are easier to use than a coffee grinder. First, we have the spectrophone, through which everything happening on Earth is heard and seen. A parlamonium, with the help of which human speech, often aggravating for the inhabitants of the Moon, who are spoiled by the music of the spheres, can be translated into music. And an oniroscope, with which the dreams of Earthlings can be observed. That is significant because of the interest in psychoanalysis that is prevalent on the Moon. You will now listen in on a meeting of this Moon Committee.
I hereby open the 214th session of the Moon Committee for Earth Research. I welcome the committee members who are all assembled. The gentlemen Sofanti, Quico, and Peck. We are nearing the end of our work. Now that we've sorted out all the Earth's essential parts, we have decided, in accordance with the many requests from Moon laymen, to conduct a few additional short experiments concerning humans. It has been clear to the Commission from the start that the material is relatively unproductive. The samples taken over the last millennia have not yielded a single case in which a human has amounted to anything. Taking this established scientific fact as a basis for our investigations, our meetings from now on will deal solely with proving that this is a result of the unhappy human condition. Opinions differ on what is to blame for this unhappiness. Mr. Pekka would like the floor.
I would like permission to speak on a matter of the rules of procedure.
On the rules of procedure.
I suggest that before we move on to other points on the agenda, we take note of this lunar map, which has just been published based on research done by Professors Tobias Mayer and George Christoph Lichtenberg in Göttingen.
In my opinion, the Moon Committee for Earth Research can expect nothing from this map. I notice that not even the huge crater CY2802, where we hold our meetings, is marked on it.
The moon map is dispatched to the archive without further debate.
Excuse me, but who is Tobias Mayer?
According to the Earth Archive, Tobias Mayer was a professor of astronomy in Göttingen who died a number of years ago. Herr Lichtenberg concluded Mayer's work.
I motion that we thank Herr Lichtenberg for his interest in moon research by making him the subject of our own investigations, for, as Mr. President has just rightly noted, our committee's final sessions will deal with humans.
Any objections? No objections have been raised. The committee passes the motion.
I have the privilege to present a photograph of Lichtenberg.
Let us see it. Yes, please,
let's see it.
But there are 20 people in it.
This is Pastor Lichtenberg from Oberramstadt near Darmstadt, together with his esteemed wife and his 18 children. The smallest one is the aforementioned moon researcher.
But now he is supposed to be over 30.
Gentlemen, the time allotted for the committee meeting is up. I request that Mr. Quicko tune the spectrophone in to Göttingen.
Spectrophone to Göttingen. He's not in Göttingen.
Then you'll have to search for him, but without a sound. It's our silent hour now.
London! He's in London, in the Drury Lane Theatre. They're performing Hamlet. The great actor Garrick is playing Hamlet.
Rest! Rest, perturbed spirit! So, gentlemen, with all my love, I do commend me to you, and what so poor a man as Hamlet is may do to express his love and friendling to you, God willing, shall not lack. Let us go in together, and still your fingers on your lips, I pray. The time is out of joint. O cursed spite, that ever I was born to set it right. Nay, come, let's go together.
Get somewhat noisy in here during the intermission, Herr Professor. Furthermore, His Majesty has particularly asked me to give Mr. Garrick the privilege of making the acquaintance of one of Europe's greatest scholars.
Your courteousness, my Lord Chamberlain, goes too far. His Majesty well knows that he will be fulfilling a long-cherished wish of mine by making it possible for me to become acquainted with Garrick. His acting, I can see, is beyond compare.
As you will see, his manners are in no way surpassed by the art of his acting. He is equally at home in the gilded court of St. James as in Hamlet's paper court.
Will you show me to his dressing room?
We will be there directly. Please announce us to Mr. Garrick.
I was told that the acoustics are bad, but I understood every word.
The acoustics really are bad. But when Garrick acts, not a sound is lost. It is deathly quiet, and the audience sits as if they were painted on the wall.
Mr. Garrick, we'll see you now.
I am happy for this chance to greet you. The king already let me know you would be coming.
I am far too caught up in the impression left by your acting to be able to greet you in the way I would wish.
The honor of seeing you here before me is greater than any greeting.
Some of my friends warned me against seeing you. They were afraid that I would no longer have any appreciation of the German stage upon my return home.
I cannot take that seriously. Or do you think we have not heard of the reputation of an Eiffelind or an Eckhoff here?
Unfortunately, they seldom have an opportunity to play Lear or Hamlet. Here, Shakespeare is not merely famous, but rather sacred. His name is intertwined with venerable ideas. Songs by him and about him are sung, and so a large segment of English youth knows him earlier than they learn the ABCs or the 1x1 table.
Shakespeare is our high school, although I can't forget what I've learned from my friends Sterne and Fielding.
I think I could fill many pages with what your conduct in front of the ghost taught me.
Then you won't forget an anecdote I was recently told about Mr. Garrick. A few weeks ago, there was an audience member sitting in the balcony who believed that the ghost in Act One was real. His neighbor told him it was an actor. But, responded the first, if that's the case, why was the man dressed in black himself so frightened by it? The man dressed in black, that was Garrick.
Oh yes, the black garment. I wanted to talk about that. I have frequently heard you being reprimanded because of it. although never between the acts or on the way home or at a meal directly afterwards, but always only after the first impression has lost its force, during a cool, sober conversation. And I never quite understood this reproach.
Yes, I'll admit to you that I have reasons why I dress this way. It seems to me the old costumes on the stage can easily become a masquerade. They are beautiful when they are pleasing, but the deception that then comes into play is rarely offset by the pleasure in their beauty.
You feel the same way about actors in old costumes as I do about German books in Latin script. To me, they are always a kind of translation.
Allow me to speak about my combat with Laertes in the last act. My predecessors wore a helmet in that scene. I wear a hat. Why? I absolutely feel the fall of a hat during a fight. I feel the fall of a helmet far less. I don't know how firmly a helmet should fit, but I feel every slight shift of a hat. I think you understand me.
Perfectly. It is not the business of an actor to awaken the antiquarian in the audience.
I once read something by an old Spaniard who said that theater is like a map. Valladolid is only a finger's breadth away from Toledo. One has barely seen a person who was 16 years old when he appears again at 60 on the stage. That is true theater. One should not hamper the trade with pedantry. Please excuse me. My scene approaches. I trust the gentlemen of the committee will not think me high-handed for switching it off, but I think our material is complete. I am convinced that we can conclude our debate without further ado. The unhappiness of Professor Lichtenberg can no longer be a mystery to us. You have seen him in the most dazzling society, and at that moment in his existence, when the world seemed to open up for him, he was a marvelous guest at the English royal court. He had the privilege of speaking to the great actor Garrick about the secrets of his art. He visited England's great observatories and got to know the wealthy nobility in their castles and seaside resorts. The Queen opened up her private gallery, and Lord Calmsholm opened up his wine cellar for him. And now he is supposed to go back to Göttingen, and his cramped rental apartment, which his publisher has allocated him as payment for his writing. He must exchange his box at the theater for his window seat. He must struggle with students who are sent to him for room and board by distinguished Englishmen. He, who calculates lunar eclipses and planetary conjunctions, is supposed to simultaneously calculate the pocket money of the young lords and idlers boarding with him. Don't you see how the misery of this existence, with its intrigues at the university, the gossip of the professors, the resentment and narrowness, must embitter him and turn him into a misanthrope before his time? His unhappiness, do you really need to look for it? It is called Göttingen and lies in the kingdom of Hanover.
I think I speak in the name of all the citizens of the moon, and especially of our research committee for the study of the Earth, when I most gratefully thank our colleague and technical director for his interesting remarks. We are dealing here with very illuminating comments, whose special beauty is that they are kept within the frame of our short speeches. However, I would like to oppose the proposal that we break off our research at this point. Because why? Even if the professor is trapped in the narrowness of his small university town, should he not rise high above it on the wings of his dreams?
In the attempt to tune the spectrophone into Göttingen, it turned out that it is now nighttime there. There is absolutely nothing for us to investigate.
That seems to me a welcome opportunity to prove my conjecture correct and put the Oneiroscope into operation. Give the directive to headquarters. May I request you, Mr. Quico, to proceed to the Oneiroscope and tell us what you perceive therein?
I see Herr Professor George Christoph Lichtenberg as he sees himself in a dream. He is floating far above the earth, across from a transfigured old man whose appearance fills him with something greater than mere respect. When he opens his eyes and sees him, an irresistible feeling of worship and trust pervades him, and he is just at the point of prostrating himself in front of him when the old man speaks to him. "You love investigations of nature," he says. "You shall see something here that might be useful to you." And now he is passing him a blue-green sphere, here and there, dotted with gray, which he holds between his index finger and his thumb. Its diameter is not more than a few centimeters. "Take this mineral," continues the old man. "Examine it and tell me what you have found." Lichtenberg turns around and sees a beautiful hall with all kinds of tools. I can't describe them to you, however. Now he takes a look at the sphere and feels it. He shakes it and listens to it. He touches it to his tongue. He tests it against steel, glass, a magnet, and determines its specific weight. But all these tests show him that it is worth little. He remembers that in his childhood, he bought the same ball, or one that was not so very different, at a cost of 3 for a kreutzer at the Frankfurt Fair. He finds some clay soil, about as much chalky soil, a lot of silica, and finally some iron and some common salt. He is very exact in his investigation, because as he adds up everything that he found, it comes to exactly 100. Now the old man steps in front of him, glances at the paper, and reads it with a gentle, almost imperceptible smile. "Do you know, mortal, what it is that you were examining?"
"No, immortal, I don't know."
"Then no. It was on a smaller scale. Nothing less than the entire earth."
"The earth, eternal great God, and the oceans with all their inhabitants, where are they?"
"There they are, in your napkin. You wiped them away."
"Oh dear, and the skies, and all the splendor of solid ground."
"The skies, they should be caught there in the cup of distilled water. And your splendor of solid ground, how can you ask? That is dust. There is some on the sleeve of your jacket."
"But I didn't find a single trace of silver and gold, which make the world spin."
"Bad enough I see that I must help you. Know this. With your fire steel, you have smashed all of Switzerland and Savoy, and the most beautiful part of Sicily, and in Africa, an entire stretch of more than 1,000 miles is totally ruined and uprooted. And there, on that glass plate, they just crashed down. The Cordilleras were lying there. And that thing that flew into your eyes when you were cutting glass, that was Chimborazo. To my regret, I must announce that the image is getting blurry. The dream seems to be nearing its end. Morning must be dawning in Göttingen."
"Finally, the professor's science laboratory."
"Ugh, stuffy it is in here, and the shutters are still closed. Oh, beautiful air, a beautiful morning, but what dust. He has made himself cozy here while I've been home for 8 days, and even the dust cloth is nowhere to be found. Well, now look lively." "For heaven's sake! For heaven's sake!"
"What happened? Impossible. The electrification machine."
"Oh."
"Yes, that is my just punishment for sleeping late. What was it that my esteemed teacher Tobias Mayer always said? Life consists of the morning hours. And that is why I have made it a rule for myself that the rising sun shall never find me lying in bed as long as I am healthy." "Well, then, we will just have to write to Braunschweig and order a new cylinder for 2 louis d'or, and we'll just have to see how we can manage without artificial lightning for the next weeks. Well, what is there to cry about? You can't be crying about the damage. I know you're crying about your toy box, but what more could happen to it now? I really wish you had completely different toys. You should have been with me that time in London to see Mr. Cox's museum. You wouldn't have been able to keep from moving among all the magical apparatuses on your tiptoes. There you would have found snakes climbing up trees, butterflies moving their wings, studded with diamonds, tulips opening and closing, waterfalls flowing from sinuous glass tubes that quickly spun on their axes, golden elephants with golden palaces on their backs, swans swimming away across mirrors, crocodiles eating golden spheres.
Will you take me to London sometime?
London? I become quite agitated when I think about London and about how it is that those popinjays, Armsdale and Smeath and Boothwell, who sit in my lectures and waste my time with their visits to the house, how is it that they deserve to live in London? And yet England remains the nation that has produced the greatest, most active people. Not those who are the greatest at promoting themselves or at book learning, but the most steadfast, the most magnanimous and bold, the most intelligent. There is nowhere that humanity is more respected than in England, and there everything is enjoyed with both body and soul, in a way in which we who live under military governments can only dream of. Dream. That reminds me, I wanted to tell you about a dream I had today. But you must keep it to yourself. It wouldn't help my reputation if it was known that a natural scientist dreams. I think that sometimes dreams can open the way for doubts that I don't acknowledge to myself during the day. And then in the morning, when I remember them, I'm not at all unhappy to see them. To doubt is human. In short, I dreamt of open space, far away from our Earth, near the moon.
Eberhard's coming with a letter.
Well, it's high time he returned, because there seems to be a thunderstorm approaching. Come in.
Good morning, Herr Professor. The Justice has sent me. The Justice has received a letter from Gotha for the Herr Professor.
I thank you. Please send the Justice my respects.
Good morning.
Just let it sit. I don't really want to open it.
Why don't you want to open it?
I have an apprehension.
What do you mean?
I have an unpleasant foreboding.
But why?
It's my superstition again. In every object I see an omen, and I turn 100 things a day into oracles. I don't need to describe this to you. Every creeping of an insect serves to answer questions about my fate. Is that not strange in a professor of physics? Perhaps it is, and perhaps not. I know that the earth turns, and yet I am not ashamed to believe it's standing still.
But what could be written in the letter?
I don't know, but when I heard the glass shattering just now, it seemed to herald bad news.
You must allow me to open it.
That wouldn't help. You can't read the gentleman's handwriting.
Gentleman? What kind of gentleman?
No doubt the gentleman from the life insurance.
What is that, a life insurance?
A company. They would have paid you something after my death.
I don't like to hear you talk that way.
My premonitions were reliable, at least this time. The gentleman writes, "Dear especially highly esteemed Herr Professor, in response to your letter of the 24th of this month, we regret to inform you that on the basis of the report made by our doctor, to whom we submitted the certificates and documents you provided, we are unable to offer you a life insurance policy." That should feed my morbid thoughts.
What does that letter even mean?
The thoughts it leads me to are much worse than the letter itself. Hypochondriacal, if you know what that means.
How would I?
Hypochondria is fear of going blind, fear of insanity, fear of dying, fear of dreams, and fear of waking up. And when one has awakened, it means observing the first crow to see if it swoops by the tower to the right or to the left.
I didn't imagine this morning to be like this.
It is quite a beautiful morning, although humid. And when I look outside into the greenery, I can no longer make rhyme or reason of the odd ideas I had last night. Imagine, yesterday, when I was half asleep, it seemed to me, suddenly, that a man was like a 1x1 table, and later I awoke when I heard my own voice saying, "It must cool so splendidly," and thought of the principle of contradiction, which I had visualized as if edible before me.
Don't you want to close the window? A wind is springing up.
And a strong one it is. There will be a thunderstorm soon. At least we no longer need to mourn our cylinder, because in a few minutes we'll have the most beautiful lightning sent directly to our laboratory for our use.
Is the lightning rod finished?
Yes. Since yesterday noon, the first German lightning rod can be seen on this house, and now dear God wants to put it into operation directly.
There's a thunderstorm in Göttingen right now. Unfortunately, we are faced with the necessity of switching off.
Perhaps I may use this intermission to announce some observations I have made relating to the subject of our discussion.
Mr. Sapanti has the floor.
I'm afraid I cannot agree with our dear Mr. Quicko's remarks regarding the German philosopher Lichtenberg. Anyone who has followed this conversation with his girlfriend must conclude that it is not the external circumstances that are ruining his life, but his own temperament. Yes, gentlemen, I won't hesitate to describe the poor professor as sick. Please recall, a professor of physical science a man who is used to linking the phenomena of the world to their causes and effects, and who bases his life's happiness and his peace upon insects and crows, dreams and intimations. Whether this man was in London or Paris, Constantinople or Lisbon, the most vivid of lives and the most refined of courts would be lost on him, as he would just sit there, all hunched up and mournful, like a night owl. Such a man can certainly not amount to anything. Do we need proof of that? Gentlemen, I submit the evidence for the perusal of the Academy. Photographs of the Göttinger Taschen calendar, courtesy of a resourceful operator on Neptune. Take a look at the entries written by the quill of this Herr Lichtenberg. Are these subjects worthy of a scholar? Observations about the preparation of ice cream in India, and about English fashions, about first names, and about samples of strange appetites, about the use of flogging by diverse peoples, about bells, and about animals' aptitude to learn, about carnival customs, and about menus, about marriage.
I am reluctantly obliged to make our esteemed member, Mr. Sofanti, aware that not only is he, in the understandable excitement that accompanies his remarks, on the point of exceeding his time for speaking, but also that, due to the well-known phenomenon of time warp between the Earth and the Moon, we have lost a year in our contact with the subject of our observations, Herr Lichtenberg. We will try to tune the spectrophone to Göttingen again.
The Herr Professor is not in the laboratory, but in the office of his present apartment in the house of his publisher, Dietrich. Using the files in our archive, we have been able to establish that Herr Dietrich lets Professor Lichtenberg live with him for free, so that the professor will write for his Göttinger Taschen calendar for free. Now Herr Lichtenberg is seated at his desk. We are adjusting precisely and are thus able to follow his hand, which holds the quill. The candle is to the right of the writer. The light conditions are quite favorable.
My very dearest friend, I call that true German friendship, dearest man. 1,000 thanks for your thoughts of me. I have not answered right away, and heaven knows how things have been for me. You are, and must be, the first to whom I confess it. Last summer, soon after your last letter, I suffered the greatest loss of my life. What I am about to tell you, no other person can ever know. I met a girl in the year 1777, a burgher's daughter from this town. At the time, she was just a bit older than 13 years old. Such a model of beauty and gentleness I have never seen in my life, even though I had seen many. The first time I laid eyes on her, she was in the company of 5 or 6 others, who, as the children here do, were selling flowers to passers-by on the ramparts. She offered me a bouquet, which I bought. I was accompanied by 3 Englishmen who ate and lived with me. "What a charming creature she is," said one of them. I had noticed that, too, and because I knew what a Sodom is our refuse heap of a town, I thought seriously that I should remove this splendid creature from such trade. I finally spoke to her alone and asked her to call on me at my house. She wouldn't go to any fellow's quarters, she said. When she heard that I was a professor, however, she came to visit one afternoon with her mother. In a word, she gave up the flower trade and spent the entire day with me, and I found that this splendid body was inhabited by such a soul, such as I had long searched for but never found. I instructed her in writing and arithmetic and in other branches of knowledge that, without turning her into a blue stocking, developed her intellect even further. My scientific apparatus, which cost me over 1,500 thaler, attracted her at first because of its gleam, but finally the use of it became her only entertainment. It was then that our acquaintance was raised to its highest point. She went away late and came back with the day, and all day long her concern was keeping my things, from necktie to air pump, in order, and all with such heavenly gentleness which I had never before thought possible. The result was, as you will have suspected by now, that as of Easter 1780, she stayed with me completely. Her inclination towards this kind of life was so great that she didn't even go downstairs except to attend church. She was not to be torn away from it. We were continuously together. When she was at church, I felt as if I had sent away my eyes and all my senses. In the meantime, I could not look at this angel, who had entered into such an association, without the greatest emotion. That she had sacrificed everything for me was unbearable to me, so I asked her to join at the table when friends ate with me, and gave her the clothing that her situation demanded, and loved her more with every passing day. It was my serious intention to also unite with her before the eyes of the world. Oh dear God! And this heavenly girl died on the 4th of August, 1782, in the evening as the sun went down. I had the best doctors. Everything in the world was done. Consider that, dearest man, and allow me to end here. It is impossible for me to continue. G.C. Lichtenberg.
Unfortunately, gentlemen, we are forced to recognize once again what lamentable afflictions are caused on planet Earth by the existence of death, which is so interesting in itself, and which, as you are well aware, is unknown to us here. I believe I act in accordance with your wishes if we let music accompany the soul of the deceased little flower girl on its path into space. To my regret, I must announce that the spectrophone has meanwhile shifted so far that it will take us all a great deal of effort to bring Herr Lichtenberg back into focus.
Indeed, there has been a shift of a millionth of a millidegree. We are no longer in Göttingen. According to my measuring instruments, it must be Einbeck, which is not far away. Silence.
Herr Professor, I think...
Silence. Listen to Lichtenberg's voice. It comes from Einbeck.
Herr Professor, we should retreat to the tavern. The noise threatens to become too distracting here.
Here comes the whole crowd marching behind the town crier.
The citizenry of the town of Einbeck, on the orders of the laudable municipal authorities of this town, are hereby informed that the infamous, unworthy, and learned apprentice of murder, Heinrich Julius Rüttgerath, will be sent from life to death today, the 30th of June, this afternoon at 3 o'clock on the hill outside our town. The same Heinrich Julius Rüttgerath was a respected citizen of our town of Einbeck, who enjoyed, in addition to his food, 1,500 thaler in income. But he killed his mother because she, so he said, ate too much. He invented a machine which, according to the opinion of exceptional professors and university technologists, is of the greatest credit to the human intellect. He placed a certain number of boards together in a barn in such a way that, as soon as his mother stepped foot on one of them, she set them all into motion, causing them to collapse on her head. He achieved his goal without a single nail and without any other injury being necessary. He beat his wife to death because one morning she didn't make his coffee the right way. He could name no other motive at his trial. He struck his maid dead in the cellar because he no longer wanted to feed her small child. All the professors and justices agree, however, that despite his inclination toward the greatest in humanity, there must have been hours when his conscience tortured him, for he never could tolerate daylight. Instead, he sat the entire day with his shutters closed, and incidentally, it has been certified that his senses were healthy and his mind whole. Indeed, he was among the most acute of men. This monster in human form will now publicly be sent from life to death, on which account his offenses will once more be held up to him and his confession taken in front of the assembled people.
I do reproach myself, dear Herr Lichtenberg, for encouraging you to join me on an excursion during which your ears must be assaulted by such a vulgar outcry.
I would have asked the innkeeper to close the windows if I didn't note in myself a certain interest in criminal cases such as these, Justice.
Say what you like, but I know that it's only because of your friendship with me that you consented to join me in such a dubious adventure as this execution, such as executions are.
I trust we won't be witnesses of it, at least as far as concerns myself. I must.
Whatever are you thinking of? For me, it's simply a matter of getting my hands on the files directly after the delinquent has been put to death.
Don't tell me you are working on a pitfall of our kingdom of Hanover.
I cannot deny it, dear professor.
Well, then, perhaps you'll allow me to tell you about a short play I saw years ago at a London marionette theater.
Just allow me to close the window. The noise is beginning to get too loud, after all.
Well, there was a puppeteer who had set up his tent in the open near Covent Garden. For a few pence, one could sit there for hours. There was one piece among those in his repertoire which I have never forgotten. It was, as I said, a puppet theater. But whereas usually the puppets in such a theater represent people, in this one they truly only represented what they were, marionettes. 5, 6, 7 of these marionettes were hanging in front of a curtain, a merchant, a soldier, a clergyman, a housewife, a judge. They swayed back and forth in the breeze and conversed. What about? You'll never guess. It was about freedom of the will. It was a peaceful conversation, because there was really only one opinion among them all. Reason, nature, and religion combined their weight in favor of free will. Only one puppet, which hung somewhat to the side, I think I forgot to mention it before, was not so resolute. I think this puppet was a philosopher, or maybe a professor of physics. But the others didn't set great store by his opinion. All at once, a broad cardboard hand appeared from above. This was supposed to represent a human hand. It took away one puppet after the other. It was very clear. The marionette player was taking his puppets off their rack. As one after the other floated up into the heights, the ones that were left asked why they went away, and each one had some sort of excuse. But the hand of the puppeteer was never mentioned, and finally the philosopher or professor of physics was left alone on the empty stage.
I'm not sure what you're trying to say, dear colleague.
I don't mean to say anything. At best, I want to ask something. Whether, when we break a murderer on the wheel, we don't make the same mistake as the child who hits the stool he bumps against.
Excuse me, gentlemen, for bothering you. If I could ask the gentlemen to glance at my collection. The best assortment of silhouettes you can find anywhere. One for a silver coin. The King of Hanover, the King of Prussia, the gentlemen Danton and Robespierre, of whom so much is said, and Herr Goethe, assistant legal secretary of Weimar and author of Werther, Herr Berger of neighboring Göttingen, the great world traveler Herr Forster, the gentlemen Iffland and Kopf, the pride of the Berlin Theater, Mademoiselle Schroeder of Weimar, I can't count them all for you. No interest. Well, then the gentleman will certainly not spurn a little memento of the day. I present to you the finely cut silhouette of our local monster. Please take a look at the text by Herr Lovater on the back.
An inveterate murderer full of quiet evil burrowing in on itself, an assassin of women, a mother killer, a miser such as no moralist could ever have thought up. No actor portrayed, no poet written about. He reveled in nocturnal gloom, turned midday to midnight by closing his shutters, locked his house, averse to light, averse to people. He buried his stolen treasures in the earth, deep within cellar walls, under floors and in fields. Spattered with the blood of innocence, he danced, laughing on the wedding day of the women, whom later he struck dead at the grave she had herself unknowingly prepared at his behest and in his presence. All this can be read in his likeness. His eyes look at nothing. His smile is like the open grave, and his fearsome teeth are the gates of hell. This leaflet is worth a silver coin to me.
And to me, it's even worth two, because there's a story behind it.
What do you mean?
I don't mind letting you in on a little story. I indulge myself in a joke, but it has to remain between us.
Discretion is part of my job.
I know. Even so, I wouldn't dare to tell you if I didn't know that we hold the same opinion of Lavater's theory of physiognomy, which has become quite the rage these days.
What surprises me about Herr Lavater is that he, so attentive to the signs that allow character to be intuited, should have failed to notice that people who write the way he does are absolutely not to be believed. We, however, know that the manner in which a testimony is presented can sometimes be more important than the testimony itself.
All right then, listen to my story. Circumstances, which I do not wish to touch upon here, made it possible for me to send the silhouette of this monster, whom they are finishing off out there, to Lavater, and I did it in such a way that he neither knew who was portrayed, nor that I was the one who sent it. And now, listen to his response. I carry it with me. Such a leaflet is worth more than a kingdom.
Let's hear it.
This profile undoubtedly belongs to an extraordinary man who would have been great if he had a little more mental acumen and more heartfelt love. Whether I err in thinking I have discovered in him the aptitude and inclination for the establishment or dissemination of a religious sect is an open question. I can say no more. That is already too much.
I never heard a true word. That's a fortunate experiment you did with that physiognomist.
If physiognomy becomes what Lavater expects it will, then children will be hanged before they have done the deeds that deserve the gallows.
But perhaps we shouldn't speak of the gallows here, so near the gallows mound.
I am glad that the noise has moved on. I still shudder when I think back to the morning when I saw, for the first and last time, someone who was awaiting the gallows. It was in front of the Court of Assizes in London. The poor fellow stood in front of the jury, and as they read the death sentence, the Lord Mayor of London was sitting there, reading the newspaper.
I think it's time to depart. The moon is already shining through the window.
A waning moon, and murky as well. There's nothing I hate more than the sight of the moon when it...
Gentlemen, you hear the attacks that Herr Lichtenberg is just about to make against us. It is beneath our dignity to follow this any longer. I am switching it off.
Without wishing to condone the impulsive actions of our esteemed colleague Quico, I will now give the floor to Mr. Pekka for his observations.
Esteemed sirs, you will all have noticed that the spectrophone's images were clearer than ever this time, perhaps as a consequence of the thunderstorms that purified the Earth's atmosphere. We all had time for a close look at Herr Lichtenberg, and I think I speak for all of you when I say we can rest assured that the solution to our problem is closer than we suspected. Herr Lichtenberg is an unhappy character, not because of the external circumstances that keep him in Göttingen, not because of his inner constitution that has turned him into a hypochondriac, but quite simply because of his appearance. It cannot have escaped you that he is a hunchback. Yes, gentlemen, it's easy to explain why a hunchback has nothing good to say about the science of physiognomy. He has scarcely any other choice but to form his own opinion about everything, because he cannot agree with public opinion on at least one very important point. I mean, as far as the hunch is concerned. We should also not be surprised to hear him speak ill of Lavater as of enthusiasts and geniuses. Anyone whose physique invites criticism such as his does is left with no choice but to go on the defensive as a critic himself.
We thank Mr. Pekka for his clear and timely explanations, but whether he is correct to say that such a hunchback is entirely incapable of enthusiasm or surges of feeling is something we should put to the test.
A report has just come in from Venus about an occurrence that I consider of great interest to us. The 50-year-old Lichtenberg, that enemy of sentimentalists who has been loyal to reason his entire life, is about to betray it with the muse. He is composing verse. That is to say, he is declaiming.
A welcome opportunity to deploy our parlimonium. We will listen to the beginning of this poem and then translate it into music.
Quiet, please.
What if at some point the sun did not return, I often thought. If I awoke in a dark night and was glad when I finally saw daybreak again. The deep stillness of early morning, the friend of reflection, combined with feeling of increased strength and renewed health, awoke in me then such a powerful trust in the order of nature and the spirit that guides it, that I believed myself as secure in the tumult of life as if my fate lay in my own hands. I thought then that the sensation, which you can neither force to come about nor feign, and which grants you this indescribable feeling of well-being, is certainly the work of precisely that spirit. And it loudly tells you that now, at least, you think correctly. Oh, do not disturb with guilt this heavenly peace within, I then said to myself. How would this dawning day break for you if this pure mirror brightness of your being no longer reflected it into your interior? What else do you expect from the music of the spheres, if not these contemplations? What else is the chiming together of the planets but the expression of the certainty which the spirit, at first with a storm of raptures, then gradually more and more? Quite a splendid cortege.
Hush, you're not allowed to talk here in the funeral procession. Wait until we're there.
It's quite a splendid cortege, is what I wanted to say. When I think back to the time they buried Berger here, three men followed the coffin, Professor Althoff.
Shh, you'll get us into trouble.
Now the head of the procession has already arrived. The music will stop soon, and then it'll get serious. Speeches will be made.
He's said to have believed in the transmigration of souls. I heard it from Poppy the mechanic himself. He's the one who built him his instruments.
Do you see where I'm pointing? Do you know what it is?
That's impossible. You're right. His window. So he could look down from his laboratory at his gravesite. That's what I call having all your affairs in order.
He's said to have stood at that window and watched Berger's burial through a telescope. But when he saw the hearse rolling through the churchyard gate, his servant, who is in the next room, could hear sobbing. He could not bear to watch the body being taken off the wagon. He closed the shutters and shut the window.
His whole life he flirted with death. This happened 7 years ago, but I remember it as if it were yesterday. The angels have let me know for some time in no uncertain terms that they feel a strong inclination to haul me to the churchyard in a small portable house as soon as possible. Yes, he wrote that to me 7 years ago.
It said that he was a believer in the transmigration of souls.
If his soul is transmigrating, then he could land on the moon. He always loved long journeys.
I can hardly credit that he was a professor of physics. What is matter, he's supposed to have said. Perhaps there's nothing of the kind in nature. One kills matter and later pronounces it dead.
You shouldn't believe everything they say about him. He hadn't gone out in public for a long time. There's movement over there. They've lowered the coffin into the depths.
It is an outrage that the professors didn't even find it worth their while to cancel their seminars today.
It really is quite a beautiful funeral cortege, if you remember Berger's funeral wear.
Shh. Insolent behavior.
Disrespectful bunch.
Highly esteemed mourners, most particularly the honorable representatives of the university and the esteemed citizens of the town.
I open the last meeting of the Moon Committee for Earth Research. By a lamentable turn of events, the subject of our observations, the University of Göttingen Professor Lichtenberg, died before we could conclude our work. However, if I have switched off the funeral service, whose initial sounds you just heard, it is by rights, as our committee has every reason to hold a separate funeral ceremony for Herr Lichtenberg. For what would our scientific honor be worth, gentlemen, if we did not concede that we had amends to make to the deceased? Admittedly, gentlemen, it has been confirmed that humans are not happy. But we have too hastily drawn conclusions from that. We concluded that they can therefore amount to nothing,
Now, it might seem that Professor Lichtenberg confirms that. You will all have inspected the extensive catalog of works the deceased wanted to write but never wrote. The Island of Cebu, and Kunkel, and the Paraclector, and the Double Prince, and whatever else they are called. But, gentlemen, perhaps he didn't write books simply because he knew what their fate would be. As he said, for every one book that is read thoroughly, thousands are merely leafed through. Thousands more lie quietly around. Others are wedged on top of mouse holes or thrown at rats. And on top of others, so he says, people stand, sit down, drum, bake gingerbread. Others are used to light pipes or to stand beneath windows. Caring little for books, Lichtenberg cared all the more for thought. Thanks to our methods of photography we possess today, the entries he wrote in his diaries, which will likely one day gain a reputation for themselves on Earth. As I'm sure you will have ascertained for yourselves, gentlemen, these diaries are full of curious, deep, and wise insights at which he might never have arrived had he possessed the untroubled cheerfulness that is ours on the moon. I therefore venture, most esteemed gentlemen, to call into question the basis of our research, that is, that humans can never amount to anything because they are never happy. Perhaps it is their unhappiness that allows them to advance, some of them, as far as Professor Lichtenberg, who is worthy, and not merely because of his moon map, of all the honor we can bestow. I therefore propose that we elevate crater number CY2802, in which we hold our meetings, into the company of those craters here on the moon that we have dedicated to the minds on Earth we deem worthy. The craters, those at the edge of the cloud sea, those on the heights of the lunar mountains, that bear the exalted names of Thales, of Helvetius, of Humboldt, of Condorcet, of Fourier, should accept into their ranks the Lichtenberg crater, which lies clearly, purely, and peacefully in that magical light that illumines the millennium and is comparable to the light that begins to shine from the writings of this earthly Lichtenberg. We conclude the research of our committee and switch on the music of the spheres.
This has been Lichtenberg, A Cross-Section, written by Walter Benjamin, translated by Lisa Harries Schumann, published in Radio Benjamin, edited by Alicia Rosenthal. Featuring Greg Simpson in the roles of Labu, the Lord Chamberlain of the English King, Eberhard, the Town Crier, the Seller of Silhouettes, and the Third Citizen of Göttingen. Jennifer Kaufman-Bueller in the roles of Narrator, Quico, the actor David Garrick, Maria Dorothea Steckhardt, Justice Puder, and the Second Citizen of Göttingen. Toby Kaufman-Bueller in the roles of Safanti, George Christoph Lichtenberg, and the First Citizen of Göttingen. Cara Canali in the roles of Pekka and the Pastor. Also featuring the music of Wayne Robert Thomas and the music of Greg Simpson. This play has been produced by Toby Kaufman-Bueller and Greg Simpson at Velour Underground Studios in Lafayette, Indiana. This project is made possible by support of the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency.